We're still at Esther chapter 1. And I've got to say, this week's message feels a bit like one of those film trailers, you know, where you catch a little bit about the film and it gives you those hints and teasers about what's coming up. And if those trailers are good, they make you want to go and see the film. They give you that sort of eager expectation of what's coming up. I remember seeing my favourite ever trailer was for the Scooby-Doo film. And the trailer was absolutely brilliant. The film was rubbish, but the trailer was excellent. And it made me want to go and see the film, but I was a bit let down. Hope you won't be let down by the rest of this book. I'm sure you won't, because it's God's Word, and God's Word never lets us down. But tonight is going to be really, I guess, a taster of things that are going to happen. And hopefully you will want to come back for more. And I've entitled it tonight, Esther, and I suppose the King's Opulence. I suppose that ought to be said in a husky trailer sort of voice, Esther, the King's Opulence. But I can't do that very well, so I won't bother. But remember last week, if you were here, we looked at the background to this whole book, this whole story of Esther, and some of the major themes that will come through as we look through this book. You might be thinking, well, you know, what can this book that was written 2,500 years ago and doesn't even mention God, what relevance has that got to me today? Well, I hope as we go through it, we will find there is relevance for us today. But it is something that we can learn from, and we can see God working through the events in this story and how that applies to us in today's society. We looked, didn't we, at the uniqueness of this book last week. It is the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention God explicitly. God's never, ever mentioned, and yet he's always there in the background. You always know that God is in control of what's going on. The start of this book is really to do about the extravagance of the king and the opulence of his court. And the description we have here at the start of this book is really of a king who is at the very height of his powers. The Persian Empire is still quite young. As you remember, the Assyrians were first, or one of the major powers. They were defeated by the Babylonians. The Babylonians were then defeated by this Persian Empire that came into being. And they were at the height of their powers. They had, an enormous area, as we saw last week. And this is, you know, the extent of the Persian Empire in its day. An enormous empire. Very powerful. And this king, King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, depending on which version you've got. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew version of his name. Xerxes is the Greek version. He is the king who rules over this tremendous empire. And he's a man at the height of his powers, and he's got great wealth, and he displays that. He lacks for nothing. He's got supreme power and authority. And he has his centre of his empire in Susa, which is just there. You can see Susa. Modern-day Shush it is, and it's in Iran today. And it was the centre of everything that happened, and that's where this great royal palace complex was built. The palace itself, which looked a bit like this, was built by Darius, who was Xerxes' father. Although he didn't quite finish it, Xerxes himself finished this whole palace complex. And it was dedicated to the god of the Persians, a god whose name I'm going to have trouble pronouncing, but I'll have a go. It's Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda is the god that they worshipped. And this palace, this whole complex, was dedicated to this god by King Xerxes. And it was a really grand, elaborate place. And probably when it talks about in the third year of his reign, he has this this time where he shows everything off, basically. It's probably the time he just finished it all. And what he does is he brings everybody in to say, you know, look how wonderful my buildings and what I've done is. You know, look how great my kingdom, my empire is. And this is the sort of summit of everything he's done, building this tremendous palace. And it was probably to show off that he invited all these people along. It was actually, it went on for quite a long time, but about 150 years later, the place was ransacked by Alexander the Great as he swept through and destroying everything in his wake, and it was pretty much destroyed. But it's been dug up archaeologically, and today, this is what we have there today. This is what's left of the palace. This is the west gate that is left, and that whole area beyond is the palace area that was once a grand palace. And that's all that's really left there today. But since the archaeological digs there, even though a lot of it was destroyed by Alexander and other people after him, there's been a tremendous amount of information that they found about the Persian Empire. And it all fits in really neatly with what we read in the Book of Esther. It does, and what we read, there's an awful lot known about King Xerxes. And everything we read in the historical documents tie in with what we read in the Bible. So that's the Susa itself. Let's think of the story then. So he has this banquet that he invites everybody to. There's actually a contrast in this whole book between lavish banquets that take place. There are several of them throughout this book. And also the fasting that takes place, where the Jews fast because of the danger that is coming upon them. And there's this contrast between these great feasts and banquets that the king has and the fasting that the Jewish people have as well. But of course, right at the end of the book, as you'll see when we get there, the Jews themselves instigate a feast, the Feast of Purim, which is a reminder for them of what happened, the fact they were delivered by God through this whole time. So there's quite a lot about feasting and banquets all the way through this book, and the Jews still celebrate that Feast of Purim today. So after showing off his complex for about this palace complex for about 6 months, the king invites everybody to this banquet. So we've got this whole half a year basically where he's invited people along and said, come and look at what I've built, you know, isn't it great, aren't I wonderful, I'm really, you know, a superb king, aren't I? And he then has this 7-day banquet at the end of this time when he invites all the greatest and the least in the citadel of Susa. That doesn't mean everybody in the city was invited to come. When it talks about the fortified citadel, it really means the palace complex. So it was people who were in his palace complex that were those that were invited along, and also people from around the empire, the important people, the nobles, the princes, the people who looked after the provinces, who governed on his behalf. They were all invited from all across the empire to see how powerful and wonderful this king was. So he's showing off in this time, and this banquet is the culmination of all those things. And what he's showing off is his wealth and his opulence. That's what he's doing, isn't he? All this display was really, he was making a statement about himself. That's what he's doing. He's placing himself up there and saying, you know, what a great king I am. Look at my power, look at my majesty, look at my splendor. And isn't that true that all through history, the status of people in men's eyes is always based on the power they hold, their wealth, their riches, the material possessions they have? That's how we view status, isn't it? That's how we see it. And that's how people saw the status of this king. That's how he saw himself, that status depended on what he had, possessions and power. And people put their trust in these things, don't they? People trust in their money. And you know, the Bible goes to great lengths to describe this banquet and what goes on at this banquet and the opulence of this banquet. Everything about it cries out sort of quality and expense. You know, you've probably come across ladies who want the best possible wedding they can possibly have, and they have to have everything that's perfect and most expensive and all this lavish stuff that they want as part of their wedding. Well, that's a bit what it was like, I suppose, only much more so. Everything about this banquet sort of cries out that it was expensive, that it was a quality thing. I don't suppose we can really appreciate the grandeur of the occasion, because there's probably very little today that we can compare it to. We don't tend to have those sorts of things. You don't get invited round for a 7-day banquet very often by your mates, do you? But look at verses 6 and 7. Look at what it says in verse 6 and 7 about what went on here. He says, the garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material, on silver rings, on marble pillars, couches of gold and silver, mosaic pavements of precious stones, golden goblets, all individually made. It was a tremendous show, and this did indeed speak volumes about the king. It tells us what was important to the king, doesn't it? And what was important to him was his power, his wealth, and his status. Jesus, in the New Testament, came across a rich young ruler one day, didn't he? A rich young ruler rushed up to Jesus. And what he was really after from Jesus was a pat on the back. That's what he wanted. He said to Jesus, "Yes, I've obeyed all the commandments. I've done everything that I should do. I'm doing very well. I'm quite a nice chap. I'm a decent sort of person." And he left, shocked and disappointed, because Jesus didn't tell him what he wanted to hear. In fact, Jesus said, "You know, I don't want you relying on your wealth and your possessions. That's not what's important. Come and follow me. Get rid of everything else and come and follow me." And that's the call Jesus gives. He's not interested in wealth and possessions. They're secondary to anything that Jesus cares about. Jesus cares about us following him. And again, he spoke, didn't he, about the parable or the story of that landowner. He said, you know, there was this landowner and he had fantastic crops. So good were his crops, he had to tear down his small barns and build bigger barns to fit it all in. And he was thinking to himself, "Wow, this is brilliant. I've got all this stuff. I'm amazing. I've got wealth beyond my wildest dreams." And what does Jesus call him? A fool. He says, "You're a fool, because tonight your life will be demanded of you." And where did his possessions get him then? You see, God is no respecter of possessions. God doesn't care about what we have. God cares about who we are, and God cares about the relationship we have with him. This is a king who is driven by wealth and power, and he's proud of what he has. That's what drives this man. He was a king who had the greatest army of the day and an empire that served to fuel his pride. He had a personal bodyguard of 10,000 soldiers. 10,000 for a personal bodyguard. And they were called the Immortals. This is a frieze from one of the archaeological digs in Susa. And this is reported to be a frieze of Xerxes' personal bodyguard, his Immortals. That's some of them. 10,000 of those soldiers called the Immortals because they were so powerful, because as an army they were thought to, nobody could defeat them. He thought he was invincible. That's what this king thought about himself. Nothing could touch him. He was invincible. I guess he had reason to believe that, I suppose, with everything he had. But that's not the way God looks at this king, as we'll see perhaps in a minute. He was a generous king, though, in many ways. We read there he was generous. He was very generous to his guests. He gave them everything they could possibly want. They had more than enough to eat and drink. The wine, it says, didn't stop flowing, and they could just have whatever they wanted. That's how generous he was. He served the wine in individually made goblets of gold, each one crafted, probably for the person they were given to. And again, you know, no expense spared, was there? He said that they would be free to drink as they wanted. You know, they all had different customs. A lot of these people may have been from, have been brought in to the kingdom through being conquered, as the Jews were. And he didn't want them to feel uncomfortable. He wanted them to be free to drink and to eat as they wanted to. So he didn't impose their customs, his customs, on them. They were free to enjoy it. Can you imagine being a guest at this event? Must have been incredible. I can't imagine being there for 7 days, personally. I think I'd have got bored with it after a while. But they seemed to enjoy it. And they had this fantastic time, didn't they? And at the same time, it says, Queen Vashti, she held a banquet for the women. And they had a banquet on their own, so they could have a good nag together, I suppose. I don't know. But they were all off together enjoying themselves. But I'm sure that too was a very lavish event that went on. There's a contrast here, isn't there? There's a contrast. What was happening inside the palace and what was happening outside the palace? This whole scene inside is in stark contrast to life outside the palace, where things weren't so grand. The history of the time, if you read it, tells us of a time where the people were quite oppressed. This king, he oppressed the people so that They could provide for him everything he needed, but he didn't give them very much in return. They had to work very hard for very little in return in order to keep the king in his lifestyle. They were taxed heavily, and this king made sure that he had a good life, but the people outside weren't quite so well off. You know, the Persian Empire was a patchwork of different peoples, peoples who'd been conquered over the years and brought into the kingdom, countries that had been conquered. And there were many who, like the Jews, who'd been displaced from their original lands. And that was so they could better serve the needs of their conquerors. And we saw last week, didn't we, that Xerxes' grandfather, Cyrus, permitted the Jews who wanted to go home. He'd signed a decree, and he said to them, if you want to go home, you can do. Back to Jerusalem, you can go back to your home. But most of the people had stayed in captivity, or in this land of captivity. Most of them had chosen to stay where they were. I suppose if you think about it, it's not that surprising really, is it? Most of them, nearly all of them probably would have been born there. They'd been brought up in this land. That's all they probably would have known. They'd have heard about their home. They'd have heard about Jerusalem, the centre of their worship. They'd have heard about the temple where God dwelt. But they'd never been there. And maybe it was a little bit too far off, a little bit too distant, perhaps a little bit too vague for most of them. They may have been having a hard existence where they were, but perhaps going back to their own land would have been even harder. They got pretty settled where they were, hadn't they? They had no real incentive to go back home. As this story goes on, you can almost feel the events of the narrative building. Here we have a king ruling over an empire, proudly parading his power and his splendour. Here we have the people of God in exile, originally because of their disobedience, but now they have the chance to return to their own homes, and yet they seem reluctant to do so. They've become comfortable where they are, and they're not keen to move on. You get the sense, right, even at the start of this story, before you read all the way through it, something is going to happen. There's something, if you like, going on off screen that's about to change everything. And that's true, because behind everything is the unseen orchestrator of all the events that's going on. I don't know if you've ever read War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The start of the book in some way reminds me of this situation as the narrative starts. The narrator sets a picture of what's about to happen. It says this. This is War of the Worlds, not Esther. Okay. No one would have believed human affairs were being closely watched by a greater intelligence. Yet across the gulf of space on the planet Mars, intellects vast and unsympathetic regarded our Earth enviously, slowly and surely drawing their plans against us. If you've ever heard the musical version of this, Richard Burton reads that at the start, and it's brilliant. And it sets the whole scene for everything that goes on. The point here is, not that I think Martians are looking at us and waiting to come and take us over, I don't believe that at all. But the point is, at the start of that story, people were carrying on as if nothing was wrong. They had no worries, that life was carrying on as per usual. They were getting on with their own plans, their own agendas. They had no regard for anything else. Yet those human affairs were being closely watched by a greater intelligence who was putting his plans and purposes into action. That's what's happening here. These people are being watched by God, and God is preparing his plans and his purposes, which he will bring to fruition. The unseen God is getting ready to deliver his people and return again to where they should be. And this story is an integral part of how God does that. This God, who was ignored by men who believed they were in control of everything, and by his own people, who had become somewhat comfortable in a foreign land, this God was about to change everything. Everyone in this story is about to get a wake-up call. These were like the days of Noah that Jesus spoke of in Matthew chapter 24. People were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were being given in marriage. Life was carrying on exactly as they thought it would. And yet, judgment was coming. Now what happens here, and what follows on here, may not be quite as dramatic as a flood that wiped out most of the world, that brought God's judgment upon sinful men. But we will see dramatic events take place here, where we will see God making sure his will is done. God working his purposes out and bringing his people home. What about the world we live in today? This story actually has striking parallels to the world that we live in today. It's a world where people think they're their own masters and are encouraged to do so. It's a world where wealth and power are the things that really matter. That's what people chase after. It's a world where God is forgotten, or perhaps deliberately ignored. Romans chapter 1, verse 20 tells us that people can see clearly God through what he has created. God's not hidden. God is clearly visible through what he's created. And yet people would rather assign that to chance and random acts than to God, the creator and designer. People choose to ignore God. It's a world where God's people are often outcasts and oppressed or dismissed as a hangover from the past. If you're a Christian, people think you're a little bit strange, a little bit simple. Somebody who's not really got a good grip on life, but is living in some sort of fantasy world. It's a world that refuses to acknowledge its creator. You know, King Xerxes only had to look back over relatively recent history to learn the lesson about God. He didn't have to look too far back. He could have seen God at work in the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, whom God brought down a peg or two, didn't he? And showed him who was in charge. Belshazzar, who at the feast saw the writing on the wall and was told that God was bringing his kingdom to an end and that the Medes and Persians would wipe him away. His own grandfather, Cyrus, who listened to the call of God's people and allowed them to go back and to start rebuilding the temple. And yet he fails to take note of his own history. He fails to take note of how God had worked in the quite recent past, and he still serves and worships foreign gods. The Jews, even though they're in a foreign land, a land that's not their home, have become too comfortable, and they've no real desire to go back to where they're called to be or to be with God. They too have lost sight of God. But what this story tells us is God has not lost sight of them. You know, the encouragement we can take from this book is that God has the situation in hand. If you're worried about what's going on in the world around us today, and sometimes as Christians we have cause to be worried, we needn't be, because God is working his plans and his purposes out. God is in control, even when we can't see it. God will do what is necessary and what is best for his people. And there is no earthly power that can stop him. He might not do it in the way we would expect, in the way that we would like. It may not be an easy road for us as Christians. In fact, we read in the scriptures it will be difficult. We read in the last days how things will be difficult for God's people as God brings those plans and purposes to fruition. But this world is not beyond God's gaze, and he will prevail. You see, the one thing we know about God is he's proactive, not reactive. God doesn't react to situations as they arise. God is proactive. He creates those situations. God put King Xerxes in his position of power. David reminded us this morning, didn't he? All governments are instituted by God. All powers are there by God's decree. God brought up this orphaned Jewish child, a nobody called Esther, and placed her in a position of influence and authority so that she could do something to help her people, the Jews. And the result of what happened here, the result of the persecution they faced and the fact they overcome it, eventually led Ezra and Nehemiah to taking the majority of those people home, back to Israel, back to Jerusalem. God worked his purposes out. You couldn't have made this story up if you read through it. The twists and the turns, the plots and the subplots and all the things that are going on. It's worthy of a Hollywood film. But God was working it all the way through. God had his hand upon it. And you know, God is working his purposes out today. He raised Esther up to meet a need for such a time as this. And you know what? God has put koinonia here for such a time as this. God has placed you here for such a time as this. You're not here by accident. None of us are. We're here to serve the purposes of God. We're placed here for a reason and for a purpose. Doesn't that make you feel special? God has a plan and a purpose for you, just as he had a plan and purpose for Esther. And who knows? You may be used by God to do wildly dramatic things. Who knows? Because God can use anybody who's willing to be used by him. God raised up this orphan girl to be used by him to fulfill his plans and purposes. And God has placed you here today to fulfill his plans and purposes.